Today's episode is sponsored by John Paul the Great Catholic University at Escondido, California. St. John Paul II had a deep appreciation for the arts, and you may know that he was even an actor and a writer himself. He understood how influential storytelling and art can be on our culture, really having the power to move people's hearts towards God. Inspired by this call, John Paul the Great Catholic University is forming the next generation of creative professionals who will be bringing truth, beauty, and goodness to the entertainment industry. People who enroll can study film production, acting, animation, screenwriting, music design, and even video games. If you want to foster your God-given creative talents within a supportive and faithfully Catholic environment, we encourage you to explore JP Catholic's program and scholarships. JP Catholic is offering our listeners a full application fee waiver, which you'll find at jpcatholic.edu/herald. Pursue excellence in your creative craft without sacrificing your values. Visit jpcatholic.edu/herald. Perhaps you're not actually looking for a degree, but instead you want to sharpen your storytelling skills. JP Catholic also offers free online courses, such as a crash course in storytelling. Learn screenwriting from Christians who work in the industry. Whether you're interested in a full degree or free online classes, visit jpcatholic.edu/herald. That's jpcatholic.edu/herald, as in H-E-R-A-L-D. Welcome to Merely Catholic, with me, Gavin Ashenden. We're used to the Catholic Church getting a great deal of criticism for its own failures. And it's right, it should be held accountable for falling below its own aspirations. But it doesn't get enough credit for the miraculous and compassionate work it does amongst the needy, the wounded, the oppressed. Cardinal Nichols did an extraordinary thing 10 years ago when he helped found Bakita House. It's a place that since 2015 has given sanctuary to over 190 women aged between 15 and 70, drawn from 49 countries, overwhelmingly the victims of sexual exploitation or serious sexual assault, sometimes just the slave trade. Karen Anstis is a former police officer. She knows what she's doing. She's wonderfully familiar with this extraordinary world that most of us know nothing about at all. And in a conversation with me, she charts a project that's been going for 10 years now as a Catholic response to this endemic and deeply embedded global problem, which an estimated 50 million people find themselves trapped in this modern day slavery. Described by Pope Francis as a wound in the body of humanity, and therefore in the body of Christ himself. I found this conversation took me to places I had no idea about. It opened my eyes to things I'd never seen, and my ears to things I'd never heard of. I was very grateful to meet Karen Anstis, very grateful to Cardinal Nichols for the work he's done in establishing this extraordinary venture, very proud of the Catholic Church, bringing care, liberation, healing and sanctuary to the people at the very bottom of society. Karen Anstis joins me now.
Well, Karen, as we said, the world has changed, and this is a new way of talking to people. So it's very nice to meet you in Bakita House. I didn't realize until near the conversation started that you were a policewoman. What's a nice policewoman like you doing in a place like that?
What a great question, Gavin. Good morning. Well, I did 31 years in the police. And my last 14 years, I think, were working within helping those victims that had been trafficked. I was on the anti-trafficking team. So this was kind of a natural move on because I think throughout my career, I did many different things, but I always went back to helping victims of abuse in some way. Having dealt with my first rape in about 1985, if something touches your heart and your head, you go back to it. And that just touched my heart and my head. I knew I needed to do something and I knew I wanted to help. So when the Cardinal came back from Rome and they'd formed the Santa Marta group, which I'm sure he's spoken to you about, it seemed a natural progression that he would reach out and open a house for the victims that the police were dealing with at the time.
Well, you say it's a natural progression. I mean, it might well be a natural progression for people who say their prayers and are alert to the difficulties. But just before we came on air and I was talking about my own ignorance of this, I think it's quite a profound thing for a cardinal to be sufficiently informed to want to reach out like this, because sex is a strange world, isn't it? I mean, we approach it by the use of smutty jokes and memes, but the reality of how sex works, and particularly how it works at a criminal level, is not accessible to a lot of people. And so maybe you'd expect that of all the people it wasn't accessible to, it would begin with the cardinal. So how does the cardinal get to be so well informed about sex trafficking in the capital?
Well, I certainly know how Cardinal Vincent knows. So
tell us, because I bet that has nothing to do with you.
Well, when I was in the police, we would do some quite large-scale rescue operations. And that would mean after several months of surveillance or after information given, we would go to brothels and we would take the women out if they wanted to be. Rescue, for a better want of a word.
Sure.
And when we first did it, we realised we couldn't take them to police stations because they were scared of authority. They thought that you were arresting them. They thought you were going to deport them. So that first initial step of meeting anyone in your life is so important, isn't it? You always want to make a good impression, whether it be going to someone's house for dinner, going to the pictures with someone for the first time, whatever it is, that first step is vital and is exceptionally vital when you're dealing with victims. Because they need to trust you. And they come into this situation totally not trusting you. So we thought, how can we make that very first step better? So we reached out to different people. And throughout my time in the police, different people, different faiths opened up places for us to take the women. So we particularly then began to work with the Catholic Church. They can provide really beautiful spaces. Volunteers would step forward to help. So that initial first horrifying step, often for these women, was made as nice as it could be made. We started to build that bridge of trust on that first step. So they could see that the volunteers from the church were working alongside the police, that we trusted each other. They could see that visually. And so that's how the Catholic Church became involved, really, for these reception centres. The sisters throughout the world have been involved for years with these victims. They're going back far before my time. They've done amazing work and continue to do amazing work. So to work with the church was inspirational, especially for me as a police officer, because when I first joined the police, 1983, people really didn't do partnerships. You all worked in these silos, didn't you? And now I know 100% that you need to work with each other and with other people to help. And so I think this is how Cardinal Vincent became aware of the horrendous numbers of people in our own country that needed help. But also it spreads out. It's a global problem. They say today the statistics are about 50 million people worldwide enslaved. You can look it up. I think there's been a program in our country done recently where they say there's now 122,000 people enslaved in the UK. I am not sure where they get their figures, but I know that there's been work done on it, so I'm not an expert in that arena. So the Cardinal, with a great heart, could see that there was help needed. He took it forward, I believe, to the Holy Father. There was an initial meeting in 2012 where a woman who we will call Sophie Hayes, so she wrote a book in the name of Sophie Hayes, but she was sexually exploited and she was in university in England when her journey began. So it's not someone that you would stereotype, as people often do, as a victim. From that meeting in 2012, the work continued, but also then we went back in 2014 and we took three women who had given evidence at court, very, very brave, because it's a massive step to do that, and they'd imprisoned their traffickers. They'd convicted them. And so they had a private meeting with the Pope, And after that meeting, he then formed what they call the Santa Marta Group. So again, don't quote me, but in the room were about 25 cardinals or bishops and 25 lead police chiefs from around the world. So 25 countries. I think there's over 40 now that are involved. And they were to spread awareness because it's a global problem. You can't just stop it from one country. Everybody has to be involved and everybody has to help to raise the awareness because, as you said, people in their own countries don't know what's going on, not through fault of their own, but because we need to spread the awareness because often it is a hidden crime, Gavin.
I think this is hugely important because, I mean, I can joke about myself appearing to be an old fogey, but on the whole, I've prided myself with being well informed as time's gone by. And I guess I represent a lot of people when I say that I know that the car wash people are presented as being on the edge of presenting to society a service that is sort of cheap and accessible, with everyone having a rough idea that maybe some of them are involved in something dodgy, even if it's only laundering cash because we always pay them cash. And that's about as far as it goes. What's happened in the last, I would say, 10 to 15 years to change the scale of this? Because my sense is that about 15 years ago, of course, this has always happened. There's always been slavery. There's always been sexual exploitation. But things have happened both to the notion of a city across the world. Cities have become more homogenized. The same things happen in the same cities, particularly at the level of crime, I would imagine. But I think I've coming across the whole sexual exploitation and sexual slavery scene is a shock to me because I had to open the Catholic Herald and read about your work before I had any, first of all, before I had any sense that nuns were doing this incredible work. It's obviously underpublicized, but then, as you've quite rightly said, there has to be levels of discretion in this because the people who give evidence live in terror of retribution, obviously, for a while. And so there's a balance between publicity and discretion. What's happened in the last 10 or 15 years to in this industry, essentially, which has made it become so much more of a ubiquitous problem?
I think there's many answers to that. I think, so if we go back, so our first trafficking laws didn't come into 2004 in this country.
Right.
So there was not a great awareness anywhere, really, even though the sisters, the church, other charities have been working in this arena for many, many years. There wasn't the awareness. Now, let's be honest, we're talking today on this link. So all of this technology has both helped and not helped. So it's not helped because actually it's now easier to scam people, easier to deceive people, and easier to recruit people. But it has helped because of the awareness raising. So you're talking to me today. Hopefully you might publicise some of this conversation and there we've got another bit of awareness, haven't we?
Yep.
So that's happened. We have then had, because of the awareness starting to grow, obviously Theresa May became very interested in the subject. And, of course, being quite high up in the government, they listened to what she said. So she then went about bringing in the Modern Slavery Act of 2015. So this heightens people like the police throughout the country, throughout the world. It heightens the knowledge of all the other services that link into the police now. So we're getting that awareness raising. I think, you know, we're named after Josephine Bikita. She was born in 1869, trafficked in 1877. So we're not talking about a new crime, as you said. This is nothing new. This has been going on for years. It's been going on for years in great numbers, but now we have the awareness and the means to publicise what's happening, to make more people aware. We have so many people involved in trying to prevent it, to detect it. I mean, we were always taught in the police, prevention is better than detection, because obviously if you've detected something, it's already happened and somebody's already suffered. So the prevention is the awareness raising, and we're better at that. I mean, we had a conversation, didn't we, where you said you're not aware. And I think it's not just you, Gavin. People have so many problems themselves in today's society that they're not looking for other people's problems. They're not seeing it, not because they don't want to, but A, they may not be aware, and B, everybody's got such a busy life to lead themselves.
also, if we're frank, we know that pornography is a huge problem for men. And it's one that people find difficult to talk about because of the perfectly proper stigma that needs to be talked about because, again, it's so common and it's so powerful because of the extraordinary access to it. I mean, we talk about, particularly with children, the notion that children, any child with a smartphone can see things that half a generation ago would have been completely out of reach of everybody, is an enormous change. But behind the pornography, there's another world again, which is of sexual services being sold. And again, if we're finding it difficult enough to talk about pornography, my guess is that amongst polite people, nothing about sexual services sought on the internet is ever talked about. But I'm assuming that it's an enormous industry and that there's going to be a huge amount of deception. What's the link too between legal and illegal immigration? Is there any? I mean, obviously, if immigration levels are high, then that's going to allow for the movement of larger numbers of people, and presumably add a dimensionality to the whole phenomenon.
Gavin, I was very sad for a while because trafficking suddenly became linked to immigration. So with the last government, they changed it over and put it under the immigration. And so therefore, people, if they have any awareness when it's first raised, have a very bad view of it, because obviously we know at the moment that people in our country are getting very upset about immigration and the levels. So to lump trafficking in, then people didn't have any sympathy and didn't want to know about these victims. And it's a totally different crime.
Immigration is a
crime against the state. And those people are still terrified and they're fleeing for a reason. But it's not the same as trafficking, which is a definite crime against a person. And it's a crime of brutality. And I'm very pleased to see that this current government has moved trafficking back under the safeguarding minister, which I believe is Jess Phillips. So at least we're going to get a new set of eyes on it again, a new perception of it, because if you give something a bad look, that's what people believe, don't they?
So I can see that completely. So by linking it with immigration, we're turning it into a political problem instead of a human problem, and you're cutting out you're cutting out human victimhood, because whilst there are all kinds of arguments about whether people are fleeing from injustice or they're economic migrants, this is a completely separate category. These are people who are being smuggled under the disguise or the cloak of immigration in order that the industry takes place. So that's the point you're making. It's not a political issue. It's a human issue that's been politicized.
And what I see when I see the news, and I hate watching the news because there's never any good news, is there? It's the Home Office or the government talk about numbers and then the public talk about numbers. So that's what they talk about when they talk about immigration. But we're trying to say to them, behind the trafficking, there's also people. Behind those numbers, there's people. But with trafficking as well, there's people that have been brutalised that are just so terrified. Like, please don't mix them together. And I'm not saying that the people that are fleeing for immigration aren't also terrified and don't also have good reasons for trying to come here. But the trafficking always starts with a deception. It's a deception, a journey, and then an exploitation. So those people that are trafficked here, they have no idea why they're coming here. With smuggling, you have much more of an idea where you're coming and why. And you've normally paid for it. But with immigration, they don't. They're sold a dream. And they're easily sold that dream because they're normally in places in their life of complete and utter desperation. So they believe it. It's something they want to believe. They need to believe. And so they're deceived. And then they're brought here. And obviously they're brought here quite easily because they don't know they're coming in to be exploited. They believe whatever dream they've been told, like you can come to the UK and have a really good job and you can send this money home and 10 of your family can live on your money from every month. Or they're sold, come here and you'll be educated. A lot of them are desperate for education. There's many reasons that they're trafficked. And then they get here and that is not what happens at all. And then they are exploited. Their lives are destroyed. It's the rebuilding of lives that's then become so important.
I can see that. And one of the things that I've suddenly realized through our conversation is that a change has taken place in the last 5 years, particularly for people like me, is that I don't listen to mainstream media anymore. I've been so cross at the way in which I think that, news has been. So I then choose my own media outlets, and I choose who I'm going to listen to and where I'm going to get my news from. And I've suddenly realized, because we live and learn, at least hopefully we learn, that, of course, the people that I'm getting my news from are not going to tell me about sexual slavery and sex trafficking, because I've chosen them for their preoccupations, if you like, for their preoccupations about their political preoccupations or their ethical preoccupations. And sex trafficking is very specific. It doesn't overflow into other areas. I mean, if it does overflow into immigration, as you quite rightly say, it's partly to politicize it to make it less accessible, not more accessible. So once again, we've got a bifurcation of knowledge, and people aren't easily going to find out about this unless presumably it comes through mainstream media, or they've chosen channels or platforms like the Catholic Herald and Dear Simon, who wrote about this. But anyway, it's a long way around saying not many people are still going to have access to the news about it.
Yeah.
Tell me why. I mean, I think I know the answer, but I think it also needs to be articulated. Tell me why, if a girl is promised an education and she falls into the hands of people who bring her across here, and then they lock her up and exploit her as a sex worker, is it just the fear of deportation that stops her walking out and going to a policeman and saying, "Help, I've been deceived"?
Well, within your question, you have kind of stated something that someone would presume. And that also doesn't help us when we're dealing with this situation, because they aren't always locked up. Because trafficking is a lot to do with control of the mind. So I have dealt with a lot of women that have been sexually exploited in my time, and they have had freedom to go to the shop and do the shopping for the brothel. They have had freedom of a phone. But they are so terrified. The traffickers train them to believe that nobody will help them, that what they've done is wrong, so they will be locked up. And in many countries, they have made them believe that they will have their families killed. And in some countries, that can be a reality. It's not like here where you call 999 and you hope at some point someone turns up to help. And I know the police are very stretched nowadays, but you will get some help eventually. That doesn't happen in other countries. So the way they keep them isn't even with bars and locks. It's the mind. And that's why it's such a hard crime as well to deal with, because you've got to change the perceptions in a person's mind when you first meet them of what the truth is. And it's like a bit like some of the women are duped by what the police call the lover boy tactic. So they enable a woman to fall in love with them. And then that woman is so in love, she will do anything for them. I have dealt with a woman once who came to this country on several occasions, and the last occasion was to be sexually exploited because her boyfriend, who she loved, needed money for his child's christening. But she was so in love with him that she did whatever he, even though she knew he had this other family, she couldn't see. But that woman was just 18, and she had been sexually abused since she was 9. By her family. So she was just reaching out for somebody to love her. And as soon as somebody showed her that inkling of love, she would do anything to keep it. And the rest of her brain closed down to what was going on, because there was that desperation. Because I think a lot of people as well don't know what it's like to not have friends and not be loved. A lot of us are luckier enough to have had a good family. Not saying everyone, but a lot of us, or have found love in faith, or you find love in many different ways. She happened to find it in a trafficker.
That's very interesting. I mean, I've long subscribed to the idea that we're all pretty mad, all pretty unhinged, all very needy. But nonetheless, I suppose part of the sociological definition of being middle class is you function. And this is these things happen on a scale. And it simply hadn't occurred to me that this level of thought control or therapeutic wounding would be so powerful that it would it would be the equivalent of locking a door. You've locked someone's mind. You don't need to lock the door. And then, of course, as you so poignantly described it, the process of unlocking the mind isn't quick, simple, or easy. And in much the same, I mean, psychotherapy has people arguing over its effectiveness, but presumably the agencies who rescue girls who are stuck like this, how do they even begin to instill that level of trust and the rebuilding of confidence and self-esteem that, I say rebuilding, they perhaps never had it? It sounds like the most terrible mountain to climb.
It's such a high mountain for them, but you know you need to assist them. So as soon as you meet them, it's about giving them back control, because we must remember they've had no control over anything. Whatever reason they've been exploited for, and there's many reasons as we've discussed, it's giving them back that control from that first meeting. It's building your bridge of trust in little steps, which is why I said we started working alongside the church, because the reception centres that they provided were much better for us to take these women in, so they could feel like there was, because they have no idea, do they, that people want to help, that people can help. They don't know about any of that. So it's that opening up of the doors to them, that actually this doesn't have to be your life, that there are people that care. And working with the women here, what's amazed me, because we work with a lot of volunteers as well, and my staff team, is that the women are super amazed that people want to help. And when they find out that the volunteers are doing it as well and not being paid and doing it with such a great passion, that for them is quite overwhelming. In fact, it's really strange, because we try to celebrate a lot here, because it's very important that you see a good side of life in your recovery process. And I brace myself for those good times, because not only is it magical to see, I know that some of them will break down. That for them, the actual seeing people enjoying themselves, allowing themselves to enjoy, and seeing people beside them, helping them to enjoy, encouraging them, it all falls apart for them. Because it's such a big thing that there is hope and there is love out there for them.
I guess that rather, like, if I use the word dependency, I don't mean to use it with any kind of slur. Dependency is something that happens when we simply find ourselves habitually engaged in behavior in which there are trade-offs. But it must be really quite difficult to move from that level of total dependency, because you've described control as being the central feature, to a new world where they become responsible for themselves, that takes a degree of emotional resilience and confidence and trust, all of which will have been squeezed out of them in the former period of control they were subjected to.
And of course, we're talking about individuals, aren't we? We're talking about men, women, and children. I mean, we speak specifically about women today because of the key to house, but it's everyone. Everyone can be affected by it. And I've had women that were trafficked from universities. I've had women that have never learned to read and write in any language. So it's such a broad scale of people. And therefore, you don't actually know how that person will take to the recovery process or how long. And that's why Bikita is extra special, because, we try to be more person-centred than time-centred, because those journeys can be faster than others. I've had a woman, when we first opened, she's now in her 70s. She had been enslaved by the same three generations of the same family for 40 years. Now, she was never, ever going to work with the police. And I think, Gavin, it's because she brought up the children in that family with love. And then she was found, discovered by police and taken away. And I think if she'd have given evidence, she would have given back 40 years of her life and that love. And I think by not giving the evidence, she could believe that they did actually love her, but it had stopped. It's difficult for me to explain.
You started off by saying deception was at the heart of this, and what you've just described is a fairly sophisticated act of double deception, self-deception, and then people who are trying to impose deception. Everyone has a kind of bourgeois Pharisee inside them somewhere, which we try and keep under control. Help me put mine back in the box. Why does the girl from university get trafficked? I can well understand somebody with no resources being promised anything from a career in films to some qualifications, if only she'll come along and do as she's told. What's a university girl? What deception is practiced on a university girl to traffic and control and lock her mind up?
The one from our country, and you can read it in the book, so I'm not giving anything away, fell in love with the wrong person.
Okay.
And the wrong person took her away to Europe on what should have been, you know, their first holiday together, and then basically produced a gun and put her on the streets and said, I am your boyfriend and I know where your family are and I will go back and I will shoot your brother.
So lover boy turned pimp turned mafia.
Yeah, and he was also a drug dealer. She was absolutely terrified for her family. I don't know that she would have ever given him up until she died had she not been so ill she was taken into hospital and the nurse in another country realised there was something very wrong and stepped in. And with the woman that we had from Albania, whose story I've told before, she was at university, which was, I feel, quite unusual anyway for her to have got that far. But when she was in university, and that was really her dream come true, her father sold her to a much older man into marriage. But at university, she had met her first ever boyfriend. So she made what turned out to be a very bad decision. She decided instead of getting married, she would run away. He took her to another country, kept her for a month, and then sold her for £3,000 to another male.
Good grief.
So the deceptions can be so many different things. You know, come here, we can feed you, you can get a job, you can be educated, or simply, I love you and this is how we're going to live our lives and I need you to do this for me. Or quite simply, they fall in love and then they get a gun put to their head or some other sort of threat.
So one of the things you've helped me understand, which I wouldn't have begun to imagine, is the importance of some kind of therapeutic, communal, salvific intervention. Because how on earth does anyone move from the levels of coercion that you've described to walking free when the head has been so profoundly locked? I mean, I'm aware of the level, and I've been astonished too, that people who otherwise seemed fairly well balanced can find themselves in coercive relationships, which to the outsider you think, well, what on earth, how did that happen? There must be a level of vulnerability to coercion that's far wider than I think that many of us realize. I began by saying, I assume none of us are sane, and we're all somewhere between a bit and very fractured. But this notion of coercion seems to me to go much wider and deeper than, on the whole, again, we talk about. And what you're doing is you're highlighting its effect in the whole era of sexual exploitation. But presumably it's very widespread and it applies to a lot of people. I think what I'm saying, therefore, is that many more people are capable of being coerced than one imagines.
And I think, yeah, Gavin, people want to believe certain things, don't they? They want to believe there's a better life. So it's an easy way to deceive and then coerce. I mean, something as simple as, if I think back to my childhood, I wanted to believe in something. So I believed in Father Christmas because I was told there was this great man that was going to come and bring me all these presents. And he did for several years. So it's a simple form, wasn't it, of deception in a way. It was a nice form, not compared to what we're talking about. But, you know, it's easy, isn't it, to be deceived. And I wouldn't want people who have been coerced and deceived to think that that's an easy thing to do. It's easy because of the desperation around people. And the people that do it, they're not stupid. They are trained. Traffickers are one step ahead of the police a lot of the time. They train, they find new routes, they find new ways. When I first started in the police, brothels were advertised on cards in phone boxes. That's how men found them. Well, of course, we don't have phone boxes now, so they had to find a new way of doing it. Up springs the internet. So traffickers, exploiters, they will find a way. And it's not because a person is stupid. It's often because a person is desperate and they want to believe something.
What's the world of agency like? You've talked about the Catholic Church being particularly valuable. I imagine, because if you've got nuns, of all, I mean, I'm used to hearing people complain about nuns with people who have given up the Catholic faith because they felt nuns were cruel with them when they taught them, or bad-tempered, or in some kind of way have behaved improperly. And there's an industry in Ireland blaming nuns for not looking after abandoned children properly and exploiting them. All this is part propaganda and part contested. But tell me about the role that nuns can play in acting as an agency of trusted go-between, because they're unique, aren't they? I can't see them being replicated by other agencies. I mean, obviously other agencies have ways of doing it, but perhaps you can fill in, for those of us who don't know anything about it at all, you can explain them what the horizon looks like.
I think the nuns, you see a lot of bad press, because bad press is what people want to read, isn't it? We've had this conversation before. You don't really see anything good on the news and you give up watching it, don't you? Because the public seem to want to see the bad and not the good. So they have a lot of bad press, but I can slightly divert back a little bit to something you said. So there was a sister who very unfortunately and very sadly died this year, Sister Carmel, and she has worked with the Cardinal for many, many years, and she was super amazing. She lost her parents, though, at an early age, and she was brought up by nuns, and that's why she became one. And she, to me, was very inspirational because she supported us so much here. She would give us clothing. She gave us a sewing machine. Her heart was massive, but she also guarded the Cardinal very well. So she had two sides and two jobs, but her heart was massive and she'd been brought up by them, and that's why she wanted to be one. So that's such a lovely story for me. I mean, I only began to know about nuns really when we started to do the rescue operations. And there's many other charities that do rescue operations that we worked with, but the sisters from Faith were always there to help. And then when I came here, I had to go and do a talk before we opened, and we desperately wanted some volunteers. And I went to where different communities of sisters were meeting to share their charism. I can never say that word. I do apologise. And I spoke. And so many of them stepped forward to help that in our first years of opening, I would say 90% of our volunteers were sisters. And sisters have these amazing lives. They live in other parts of the world to help people. So they come to me with so much world experience and languages. Some of them speak 2, 3, 4 languages, and they've done everything in their life through their faith and through their heart. So they're not as they're portrayed at all. And often they've had jobs in education. So I've had ex-headmistresses that work for me, so ex-school teachers, and they seem to have the patience. Well, they do have the patience of a saint, because they're very much like saints in my eyes. Sometimes you need the patience of a saint, and they bring that as well. They bring me knowledge from around the world because of the places they've lived, so I can feed off that knowledge of cultural differences. They do everything with such good heart. They bring so many different skills, and they're friends. And do you know what? That's what so amazes me at the end of the day. They become your friends because they want to help these women so much.
That's extraordinary. And it's also wonderful to hear. It's what I would expect and hope, but you don't find very many people saying it, because, as you say, we get our information from outlets that want to major on bad news, bad gossip, the destruction of images.
They don't do, Gary. They never promote themselves, do they?
No, of course they don't.
The silent part of the church that's actually out there doing major work throughout the whole world. and they never promote themselves. And they make me that's the one thing, they make me really angry. I say to them, you need more promotion. You need to tell people what you're doing. And they just smile and think, Karen, let's just get on with this job that we're doing.
I think nuns are the secret weapon of the church. I mean, I became a Catholic a few years ago, and I remember always being quite envious of nuns. I thought, well, at least the Catholic Church have got these nuns. Nobody else has got them. But if when they work, I mean, again, the trouble is we get so much bad news, and that then and there's the. It's very hard to break the associations of rather sort of, you know, rather crabby elderly people rapping children on the fingers for not paying attention. Whereas, as you've described it, it's a completely different world, and one in which they can't promote themselves. So they require people like you, or at the very worst, me, to promote them for them. Tell me, if people watching this want to help, obviously money. Nothing can be done without money, and the costs of running centres is enormous. But what does Paquita House most need from both the church and the public, as far as you're concerned?
I think you've said the obvious thing. It is the money. I think if people could just go online, and there's so many sites with signs of trafficking, that they could make themselves more aware of what's happening. And I always say to people, sometimes we have a gut reaction to something we see and we don't believe our gut reaction. But what I would say is, it's only a phone call. That's all you have to make. You don't have to become involved any more than that. And there's a modern slavery helpline. The Salvation Army have a helpline. And then there's Crime Stoppers. So the director of operations for Crime Stoppers is my old boss from the police, and he worked in Santa Marta. So he's got a massive awareness of this, Mick has. He's amazing. You can ring Crime Stoppers and you don't even give your name. So you can give information.
Let's go back a step or two, because I'm lagging a bit behind. What am I looking at? I mean, I don't go to nail bars, though I do go to car washes. For the ordinary person in the pew or on the street, I wouldn't even know to begin. What are we looking for in order to be aware?
Car wash, Gavin.
I see four or five swarthy Middle Eastern men who don't speak English very well, who are working to provide, to undercut another service or to do it better.
Okay. So age is a thing, because I reported a car wash not so long ago, because when I went in, and I'm knocking on a bit, so everybody seems young to me, but I saw a very young boy who I thought, if you're 16 to 17 and you don't speak any English and you're working here, that doesn't seem right to me. So I made that phone call to the police. I happen to know police in that area, so I phoned the police. But otherwise, there's many people you can phone. How do they look physically? Now, we all can see somebody in front of us, so we can see how they look. We can see if they're wearing protective clothing. We can see if we go regularly, if their English is getting any better. There's so many things that we could actually see and think, is that right? Are they interacting with me, or are they kept separated from me? And there's just that one jolly person that always comes up and does the speaking.
Yeah, that's always the case, isn't it? And yes, I presume... Go on, but look, well, I mean, I'm embarrassed because, you know, there are areas which I'm competent in, and there are obvious areas where I'm an absolute dork, and I suspect I haven't even been looking. I haven't been thinking or looking beyond the kind of joking, and sometimes jokes are a way of keeping you from thinking. You sort out awkward information, turn it into a joke, and then you don't have to do anything about it anymore. And now I bite my own nails. I don't go into nail bars, so I know nothing about nail bars, but presumably there are going to be people listening to this who do go into nail bars. So what you're saying is, if there seems something exploitative at first sight, pay attention, just don't ignore it. We've got the whole racist thing. I shouldn't be interesting myself in these people, because if I do, I'm doing it as a kind of white bourgeois person, bringing middle-class standards to people who have a different culture and don't require me to impose my cultural norms on them. I must keep away and not busy myself with it.
And I kind of see that, and I don't want anybody rushing in and being a hero because that could be quite dangerous. But we can all see and we can all speak and we can look up things on the internet. We've said what an amazing thing it can be. There's signs. There's so many charities now that put the signs out there, Crime Stoppers, Unseen. They've got the signs online for people to look at. And it is a simple phone call. That simple phone call, people on the other end may say to you, we will look into it, but that's not enough, you know, for us to go forward too far. But you could, at the end of the day, technically, you could save a life. So do you want to possibly make a fool of yourself, or remember you could save a life? And we do see things and we do react. We said, didn't we, that a lot of people don't see what's in front of them, because let's be honest, everybody at the moment, it seems, in the whole world has their own problems. Even in our own country, people have massive problems, and you don't often want to see other people's problems because you're so busy trying to deal with your own. But there are people out there that are enslaved in factories, car washes, farms. People could be working alongside the people that are enslaved. I had a woman from a factory and I said, what would happen there? Why did nobody realise? And she said, because I never told them, I never interacted. Sometimes you would say to yourself, if you're working as a team in a factory and you speak to somebody and they really don't want to interact, you might presume it's because of the language barrier, but it might be something else. It's good to watch. Where do they go home to? You know, who's picking them up? There's so many signs that you can look up.
It strikes me that there is
your gut.
Well, you're showing your degree of female superiority. Some of us men are not very good at interpreting our gut. It does strike me the word slave might be unhelpful. And if you said to me, have you seen any signs of social or psychological coercion? I think my antenna would go up and say, oh yes, actually, I know a bit about that. I find the word slave unhelpful. It has images of manacles and cutlasses and locked doors. And, you know, one of the most important things you said, for me at any rate, is you don't need a locked door to enslave someone. You need a locked mind.
No.
Now, in one sense, that's absolutely obvious. But you know, one of the things about being a human being is we're always learning, and things may seem obvious, but you have to start the process somewhere.
I
find the idea of coercion much easier to respond to in terms of being a responsible citizen than I do the possibility of uncovering slavery of any
kind. And I think I totally agree with you with the slavery bit. The word is not a good word, because people will then go back hundreds of years to what they think of as a slave.
Right.
And it's not helpful. And I go to places, if they're doing something new, they've never been in this world before, they always bring out like somebody that's chained up or with handcuffs or with rope. And I'm like, but it's not those chains that are the important ones. Right. It's the ones that are in the mind. And if you put an image into someone's head, that's the image they look for, isn't it?
Yep.
So it can be quite unhelpful. It can be unhelpful that they don't realise, I think, as well, because some of us have been lucky to have such a good life with our own freedom and our own way of thinking, and we've been allowed to do that, make our own decisions, that we find it hard to understand that other people can be coerced. They can be trained in the mind. I mean, most of us are quite adamant in our views, and we've never been through that before, but it's happening out there, and not only to women, to men as well. And I think men are quite shocked that men are getting exploited. You know, that wasn't a big thing up to 2009. That really wasn't seen. And then the statistics started rising, until actually the statistics in this country at one point where there were more men exploited than women.
Not seriously. Well, when you say men are shocked, I am shocked. I mean, obviously we know children are shocked, but then again, it's difficult to ask questions about it, because an unhealthy interest in the sexual exploitation of children can be taken in different ways. To even ask about it raises questions. We can hide behind, I suppose, the virtue of wanting to rescue vulnerable women. But tell me, in the time we've got left, about coerced men, because I know very little about it.
Well, men are the same, aren't they? They come from the same situations of desperation, of wanting to feed their family, of wanting a new life. So they can be coerced and deceived exactly in the same way. I can remember, I mean, it's going back a long time. We dealt with a man who'd been, he'd applied for a job in England on the internet. He'd come over and he'd been captured and kept in a house. And he was made to go out and steal. And he did it because he was in fear for his own life and for his family. But eventually, most people will have a level where they suddenly break. And he broke and he got himself arrested for stealing. And the police rescued him and they found out that he was being kept in the shed at the bottom of the garden and the men of the house were sexually abusing him. And it wasn't to do with sex, it's to do with power. And that's often what is also confusing. Rape is to do with power. And so they did that to keep him in line, to make sure he knew that the worst things could happen to him and his family if he didn't do what he was told. And when he was rescued and brought to the police station for the police to deal with, he then turned around and said, I think it was a few hours later and everybody was quite shocked, what about the little girl? And everybody was like, whoa, what little girl? And when the police went back, I think she was 7 at the time, there was a Romanian child that was the domestic slave of the house. And that's all she did. And I think it was in, you could look it up, it was in the news many years ago. This is one of my first stories, but it sticks in my head because she in the news was called the Romanian Cinderella. So, you know, you have in one house there two examples of what could be going on. And that was going on in London. And people often say to me, in London, like they're really shocked. And I'm like, it happens everywhere in the world. And it happens in London. It could be happening next door to you. I don't want everybody going around looking through people's windows. I don't want to cause a neighbourhood stir. But, you know, I have been houses before where people have been enslaved for 10, 20 years. And I've gone to the neighbours to take it, you know, to just say, did you know what was going on? One neighbour said to me, I did think it was strange that that woman only came out every Sunday at 6 a.m. to wash all the cars. So part of her brain had clicked in that that wasn't quite right, but the other part didn't move on to, does that woman need help? Why don't I see her any other time? So, you know, sometimes we see things and don't realise we're seeing them.
Quite a lot of the time. Yeah. Karen, thank you so much for giving us this time. I've been on a very fast and steep learning curve.
We must end on a good note. And I think the good note is the women here that we work with are probably the bravest people I've ever met in my life. And they do, on the whole, move on to a better life. And it may take a long time, but there is always hope. And then there's always the cat. We can't end without saying, well done, Marley, cat of the year.
I suppose I was going to go to the cat, but I've just been so impressed by your bigging up the nuns that I thought maybe the cat would steal some of the nuns' thunder. But perhaps there's enough thunder to go around for both the cat and the nuns.
You get me.
Karen, this has been really wonderful. Thank you for everything you're doing. Thank you for making it so clear to those of us whose learning curve is steeper along than it ought to be. And bless you and all you do.
It's been a delight to speak to you, Gavin, and I really hope you have a peaceful Christmas or festive season.
If people want to help, where do they go to contribute money or anything else?
We have Caritas Westminster have a website on the Diocese of Westminster, and on there is a complete section on Paquita House where you can donate and you can see some of our amazing stories, because we've had some really good court results as well this year through the bravery of those women that we've supported. They've put traffickers, exploiters in prison.
Books, you were mentioning some books that have been written. Books. Didn't you say it's stories? People's stories have been published in books. Have they been, or did I miss it?
Published on our website.
There we go. Not books. Yeah, this is me. This is me bringing my own preferences. Websites. So where will they find the stories on the website? Same place.
The website is the Diocese of Westminster, and then there's a Caritas Westminster section, and then there's a Paquita House section.
Fantastic. It could not be clearer than that, even for someone like me. Karen, this has been wonderful. Thank you very much for talking to us. God bless you.
Now, I hope everybody has a wonderful Christmas. And please be kind to each other.
We're on it.
Thank you, Gavin. Take care.